The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Nutritional Disorders and Their Management is presented by Dr. Robert Hasty.
Excellent. So I'm excited to talk about nutrition. And, you know, of course, you know, with nutrition, it's one of those things that I think most of us as evidence-based medicine, you know, internists, you know, kind of hate a little bit because, you know, the evidence for most of these things with nutrition is really not great, right? And of course, you know, the general public says, well, you know, docs don't know anything about nutrition. So, I will say that most of the stuff that we're talking about, and I would say probably most of the stuff they might test you on, is probably weak evidence at the best, but you know that's as good as we have when it comes to nutrition. So I'll start off by talking a little bit about Parkinson's disease. So if they give you Parkinson's disease and they say which of the following diets in this patient with severe Parkinson's disease that's on L-DOPA, you know, which is probably the best diet for that patient? The answer is probably low protein diet. Because it, you know, competes with the metabolism, and you know, you can have some problems with the patient. You know, again, it's, you know, if the patient asks you what's probably the best diet, you know, for Parkinson's disease, especially if it's severe Parkinson's disease, it's probably, you know, from a treatment perspective, going to be a low protein, you know, low protein diet. Now, I will tell you that, you know, and this is one of those things. So, if they ask you a question on the boards, when in doubt, answer Mediterranean diet, because you usually cannot go wrong with Mediterranean diet. Now, the problem with Mediterranean diet, there's no uniform, you know, consistent what is a Mediterranean diet, but in general, most people would say a Mediterranean diet is one that has a lot of, you know, things like, you know, seeds and grains, you know, vegetables and fruit, probably low in red meat, you know, maybe a little bit richer in, you know, poultry and fish, or, you know, moderate intake of poultry, fish, you know, allowance of, you know, red wine, you know, little to moderate consumption of red wine is allowed, but usually low intake of red meats. And the evidence actually does show that it prevents Alzheimer's disease, or at least the incidence of Alzheimer's disease seems to be less in patients who take a Mediterranean diet. There's also some evidence suggesting that Parkinson's disease is also limited or lesser incidence in patients on a Mediterranean diet. So I would say in general, if they ask you which of the following diets and you really have no idea, you know, choose Mediterranean diet, or if they mention which of the following will reduce your chance of Alzheimer's disease, and I would say also now with the current evidence, maybe Parkinson's disease, answer Mediterranean diet. So cystic fibrosis. You know, you typically should be getting a 3-month nutritional assessment on these patients. You should be looking for the fat soluble vitamins, as you would suspect, because, you know, with the pancreatic enzymes, you know, affected, you know, so A, D, E, and K. You should also be looking for iron and probably protein stores. And you should probably be getting an AIC at least at the beginning and probably annually. There's this condition called cystic fibrosis-related diabetes, or CFRD. It's kind of an interesting condition because it's a little bit like type 1 and type 2, and it has some nuances to its management. But from a nutritional standpoint, you should be looking at definitely A, D, E, and K, iron, protein stores, and AIC. And interesting, there is an association between CFRD and poor nutrition and cystic fibrosis. So, I mean, I guess they could give you this question, you know, which of the following will, you know, be most likely, you know, to prevent cystic fibrosis related diabetes, and they'll say optimal nutrition or something like that. I won't spend too much time on this. I think that we all, you know, have probably looked at this evidence, and nephrologists are pretty good about talking about this, but I would say it's probably safe at this point. You know, if they're CKD patients, you know, probably protein restriction, you know, based upon, you know, the available evidence out there, you know, 0.6 to 0.8 grams per day, per kilogram per day for protein. You know, once they go on, you know, dialysis, ESRD, then they, you know, you typically want to prevent the catabolism, so you'll bump up your protein intake for those patients. So for cirrhosis, we should be monitoring, you know, vitamins A, D, E, and zinc in those patients. Probably wouldn't be completely, you know, inappropriate to go ahead and recommend supplemental. You also want to go ahead and give small, frequent meals with bedtime snacks, and that seems to be effective for catabolism because, you know, those, you know, those patients with cirrhosis, they come in, you know, they got the cirrhotic bellies and everything. You know, they have a lot of protein catabolism. They have the peripheral wasting, and so, you know, you want to try to, you know, prevent, you know, the catabolism. So what you don't want is them for go long periods of time without having any type of nutrition. So small, frequent meals, and bedtime snacks, and, you know, and what's a good bedtime snack for those patients? You know, probably maybe a glass of milk and an apple or something like that. So gout. Gout, you know, the evidence behind gout, obviously you should probably, you know, avoid, you know, alcohol, you know, heavy red meats, you know, having a nutritious diet for those folks. And interesting enough, low-fat dairy diet is associated with better outcomes in patients with gout. So, you know, if the patients say, okay, what can I do? Or if the question says, what can I do to improve or reduce my you know, prevalence of gouty attacks, the answer should be a low-fat dairy diet. So, you know, milks and, you know, low-fat cottage cheeses and stuff like that. And of course, you know, avoidance of, you know, alcohol intake and red meats and those type of things. And, yeah, you know, it's interesting. Probably my favorite book in the world is Autobiography of Ben Franklin. You know, if you ever read it, it's just, you know, fascinating thing. So he, you know, he talks, and, you know, of course it's autobiography. So, you know, he makes it sound like, you know, he could wrestle a grizzly with one arm behind his back, and he like invented everything in the world, which including the urinary catheter, right? Probably made out of wood back then or something. You know, I don't know. But you know, he didn't say a word about gout, right? But you go to the museum. You know, that was it, the Moody Museum or whatever that's in Philadelphia, and, you know, they have like his colchicine. You know, his bottle of colchicine, and apparently he was like, he had like terrible gout, you know, because he was drinking all that, you know, wine and red meat and stuff like that. And, you know, just imagine him, you know, walking around with colchicine, which is all they had back then. So he's like, you know, the bad gouty arthritis, and, you know, he was like walking around having diarrhea all the time and stuff. It probably wasn't quite as good as his life sounded in the book, but anyway, he should have been on low-fat dairy diet. So epilepsy. Now, I'll tell you, you know, it's fascinating. I went through medical school, residency, hours and hours of lectures. No one ever mentioned a ketogenic diet for epilepsy. You know, I don't know, maybe your experience was different, but I never heard a single thing about a ketogenic diet. And if you actually look, the data goes back to like 1920s, and it's actually pretty good. I mean, the data, I would say from a dietary perspective, from nutritional data for epilepsy, probably pretty good. Now, of course, it's a challenge, right? You know, to get, you know, truly ketogenic, and, you know, I think all of us have at least tried the, you know, Atkins diet, you know, some period of time, and, you know, to do like no carbs, I mean, it's like, you know, human torture almost, right? You know, you just want the donuts, right, or whatever, and to truly get the ketogenesis, you know, to make sure you're getting like the bad breath and everything, you know, you really have to, you know, really be carbohydrate restricted. So it's not easy. I get this guy in Idaho that he's like selling the ketones, and, you know, his claim is that, you know, he introduces, you know, he can cause ketosis. So I don't know, who knows, maybe that might be, you know, something worth studying in the future. But the bottom line is that the evidence does show that, you know, the high fat, low carbohydrate, truly ketogenic diet where he calls, you know, ketosis does seem to pretend better outcomes in patients with epilepsy. And I think, you know, if you look, you know, like up to date, it'll talk about, you know, if you have that patient on like two drug regimen and you're still having breakthrough seizures, you know, maybe you should go ahead and, you know, talk about, you know, put them on a ketogenic diet. But yeah, anyway, but the evidence is actually pretty good. So ketogenic diet, epilepsy. So let's talk a little bit about calcium oxalate nephrolithiasis. And, you know, this is one of those things that also changed, right? In the last 15, 20 years, I think it was around 2000, 2001, the data came out. But, you know, for years, we were actually telling people to be on low calcium diets. right? We thought it totally made perfect sense, right? If somebody's having calcium oxalate kidney stones, maybe we should go ahead and tell them not to eat as much calcium, right? I mean, that's just like, you know, it seemed kind of intuitive, right? So for years, we were telling people, and what actually turns out is actually you increase the episodes of calcium oxalate kidney stones in a low calcium diet, because what happened was is that, you know, you basically don't bind to the oxalate. So you actually want to avoid the low calcium diet because it's an oxalate problem. It's not a calcium issue. Now, the foods that trigger calcium oxalate diets, you know, are things like the chocolate, the spinach, the green and black tea. You know, the rhubarb is the classic thing. And, you know, people say, well, who eats rhubarb? I have a brother-in-law that's a farmer in Indiana. He's got this whole rhubarb patch behind his one of his little things. So, you know, he goes out there and, you know, he's a farmer. So, you know, he takes care of him, you know, number one, you know, outside behind this barn, you know, not on the rhubarb. And he goes over and, you know, eats some rhubarb. So he sits there and eats all this rhubarb all summer, and he started developing all these kidney stones. And, you know, so there is an association between rhubarb and that. He was drinking all these teas, like, you know, it seems like most farmers, you know, they love, you know, drinking iced teas. So he was like the classic setup for calcium oxalate kidney stones. And of course, well water, you know, there may be some association between well water and calcium oxalate kidney stones, but I don't think that's quite as well connectedly proven. Vitamin B6 pyridoxine actually may be helpful. So, you know, I mean, what's the harm, right? You know, water soluble vitamin, give them a little B6 pyridoxine. You know, it may be on the boards. I don't know. But, you know, obviously the chocolate, spinach, you know, avoidance of the low calcium diet. And remember, it's an oxalate issue. It's not really a calcium issue when it comes to nutrition for calcium oxalate kidney stones. So ICU nutrition, I won't spend too much time on this because I think that you get this in your critical care lectures. One thing that you need to know is that the post-pyloric feeding is equivalent to gastric feeding. So, you know, all those, you know, times in the past where they were torching the patient to, you know, to have the jejunal feedings and everything, and, you know, that was kind of, again, you know, we probably had some early observational anecdotal evidence that maybe we should do, like, you know, the post-pyloric feedings for the ICU patients and everything. If actually, if you look at the evidence, the gastric feeding's just as good. So, you know, just getting, you know, gastric feeding is fine. The Harris-Benedict equation is sometimes helpful. And probably the most important thing is that, you know, patients in the ICU, they need, you know, a decent amount of calories. So if you look at a patient with, you know, 70 kilogram, you know, they probably need about 2,000 calories a day. Right, if they're a 100 kilogram patient, you know, we always say 70 kilograms, but, you know, where I practice, it seems like, you know, 100 kilograms probably, you know, the more norm nowadays, right? But, you know, but about, you know, 2,500 calories a day for those folks. And the other thing is, you want to avoid the catabolism, so protein is important. So, you know, the typical recommendation for protein in patients in the critical care settings, 2 grams per kilogram per day. So, you know, probably about double the average, right? So you do need a fair amount of protein in ICU patients. Dyslipidemia, again, I probably won't spend too much time on dyslipidemia diets. You know, ATP4 really didn't have too much in terms of nutrition. ATP3, as you may recall, you know, they typically said you wanted to have less than 7% saturated fats in the diet. Dietary cholesterol consumption is like less than 200 milligrams per day, which I think like an egg is like close to that, right? Plant stanols and plant sterols, like the, you know, over-the-counter Benecol, you know, always a good choice. And it actually works pretty good. And, of course, you know, oats and fruits and legumes, you know, are currently recommended in ATP3, although it's old data, but that's still probably the best recommendations out there. So refeeding syndrome, you know, another one classic for the boards. And, you know, you probably, you know, remember when you were a kid and you used to go out and trick-or-treating. And you ever remember, you know, they gave you that like little UNICEF bucket? And on this UNICEF bucket, they had this little boy in Africa. And you probably had, right? You probably had the same bucket when you trick-or-treated, and they gave that to you in school or whatever. And this little boy had one of these big kwashiorkor bellies. You know, this, you know, poor now, you know, malnourished boy. And, you know, of course, you know, you go out there with a little bucket and, you know, you put up this little boy with, like, you know, malnourished and little kwashiorkor belly. And, you know, it took me a while to figure out that, you know, when you have that big belly extending, you know, it's not because the kid's obese, it's because they're, like, you know, dying, right, because of malnutrition. So I looked on that picture back then, and I always remember that little boy, he was holding skim milk. I was like, Okay, so if this kid is like dying of malnutrition, why'd they only give him skim milk? I mean, you know, maybe us rich Americans, we can give him like, 2%, maybe even whole milk, right? And so I try to figure out, I never knew, when I was a kid, why they always had skim milk in this picture. And it wasn't until, I went through and I was reading about refeeding syndrome, and, particularly after Nazi Germany, that they would actually give skim milk. And they found out, and the data actually rated back then, because, when you started refeeding people, they died, right? Because your phosphate gets depleted because, doing the ATP, metabolism, and the patients were dying because of phosphate deficiency. Well, skim milk actually provides some good nutrition. It's relatively rich in phosphorus. And because of the, because of its being low fat and everything, it won't trigger, the ATP, quite as much. And so that's the reason why you give skim milk. So that's the reason why they had skim milk. And so, nowadays, when they're going through and trying to prevent refeeding syndrome, somebody's been, malnourished, for a while, it's actually skim milk is still pretty good. But anyway, again, hypophosphatemia, that's why people die because with refeeding syndrome. So that person with, severe anorexia and, they come in the hospital and, somebody puts them on a regular diet and all of a sudden, they code and they die. It's because, phosphorus, right? I think the classic question is, what's the most common reason for, alcoholics having death? It's actually, arrhythmias, and a lot of times it's electrolyte related. And, refeeding syndrome is very common in that population too, because they haven't been eating, right? They've just been drinking. They come in the hospital, you start feeding them, and they can get refeeding syndrome, hypophosphatemia. Also, a volume overload is very common. So they give you that patient with anorexia, you have to manage their volume as well. And then, how you do this is you actually give them a moderation of calories. So you don't give them like a 5,000 calorie diet if they haven't been eating. You probably want to give them a very modest caloric intake. And then you want to make sure that you're giving them phosphorus and magnesium and potassium and monitoring the electrolytes very closely, particularly, potassium when you start feeding these people that, haven't been fed for weeks or whatever. Here's another one from a nutrition-related type of question. They may give you that patient with, some type of anorexia or, eating disorder, bulimia or whatever. The medication that would probably be contraindicated in that patient is bupropion. So bupropion, as you know, can cause seizures, right? I think it's like 1 out of 200 or something like that. And the patients that typically get it are people with a history of seizure disorders. So you're not supposed to give bupropion for a history of seizure disorders. And if they have any history of eating disorder, you want to go ahead and avoid bupropion. So obesity, probably some of the things that you should probably know about obesity is that there's 3,500 kilocalories in a pound. So you always wondered why this nutritionist, says, well, we're going to hold back, we're going to calculate the number of calories, which is typically, on a regular, regular metabolism, about 22 calories per kilogram to maintain your weight. They're going to calculate that, and then they're going to say, they'll say, we're going to try to go for a pound a week. And so that hypothetical band that comes in with 100 kilograms, that's 100 kilograms, they're going to say, okay, your maintenance diet should be about 22 calories per kilogram. So that's about 2,200 calories a day for that 100 kilogram male that walks in. They say, okay, we want you to lose weight. And they say, well, we think about a pound a week is about a safe diet. So the nutritionist will say, okay, we're going to recommend 1,700 calories per day for the diet. And the reason why they do that is there's 3,500 calories in a pound. You take off 500 calories a week, you lose about a pound a week. And of course you can do the math there. So I think that the two most useful numbers, when you're calculating diet for patients, and they may ask you this on the boards, 3,500 calories, or I should say kilocalories per pound, 2,200 calories per kilogram to maintain weight. You remember those, you can usually answer most of those questions. Of course, nowadays with the bariatric patients, when should you monitor them? Probably every 3 months, 6 months. It should be 3 months postoperatively, 6 months postoperatively, 12 months postoperatively, and then annually. B12 deficiency is common in these patients. Iron, CBC, CMP, ferritin, vitamin D, thiamine, folate, P, PTH. It's probably worthwhile when that, you know, that post-operative bariatric patient comes in, you know, probably just do a quick, you know, up-to-date search or something like that, remind you of what you should be checking. But, you know, the bottom line, you should just be checking a whole bunch of the stuff, and, you know, including the thiamine, folate, PTH, B12, you know, iron, ferritin. All right, so let's talk a little bit about vitamin intake. And, you know, I think most of us know that, you know, just the old multivitamin, you know, kind of like the common question that patients always ask us, you know, there's really not a lot of great evidence, you know, behind just a regular multivitamin day. I mean, there's that one study, which was an observational study that, you know, shows that if employees take a multivitamin every day, they're less likely, you know, to call in sick to work. But then again, I mean, it's full of bias, right? Because, you know, the person that is anal retentive enough to, like, take a multivitamin for their health every day is probably also those people that don't, you know, fake sickness and show up, and they probably want to show up to work and, you know, probably a little bit more conscientious. So I think there's all sorts of problems with that. You know, in general, there's not a lot of evidence for a lot of multivitamins overall. And of course, you know, vitamin C, it keeps, like, coming back over and over again. You know, I think that you probably know with vitamin C, and you probably saw that article last couple of days about vitamin C being associated with better outcomes with sepsis. You know, they showed that, I think it was thiamine, hydrocortisone, and vitamin C, there was, you know, some association. Who knows? So maybe vitamin C is going to turn out to be something good for sepsis, you know, in the near future. But, you know, it's out there. It's a pretty interesting article. But, you know, vitamin C, the patients who should probably avoid large amounts of vitamin C, calcium oxalate folks, right? So if you have calcium oxalate kidney stones, if you take a whole bunch of vitamin C, well, that vitamin C just, you know, is just like fuel for the fire because the oxalate. And so you're going to increase, you know, kidney stones. The other thing is, if you have a patient with inflammatory bowel disease, so you have those patients with Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis, you know, which of the following dietary supplements in large quantities should you avoid? The answer is vitamin C. Vitamin C. So the things that have also been proven is that a beta carotene and vitamin E for the prevention of cardiovascular disease. This is the USPSTF current recommendations. You want to avoid beta carotene and vitamin E for these patients because they may be harmful. So USPSTF recommendations, no beta carotene, no vitamin E for patients with cardiovascular disease. Again, something that's changed 20 years ago. You know, heck, probably half the cardiologists in the country were recommending vitamin E for patients. Nowadays, it's, you know, it's a D recommendation from USPSTF. The other thing is beta carotene in smokers, bad. There's some evidence that suggests that if a patient is a smoker, takes beta carotene, it increases the risk of lung cancer. So if you have that patient who's a smoker that comes in, you know, what should you tell me in terms of vitamin supplementation? Avoid beta carotene would be the answer on the boards and in real life. All right, so community dwelling, non-pregnant, asymptomatic patients 18 and older, insufficient to assess the balance of and benefits of harms for screening for vitamin D deficiency. You know, that's out there. Yeah, this one, you know, I think the one I really want to point out here is if you look at non-institutionalized postmenopausal women. So you have that 55-year-old woman out in the community. Should I take vitamin D and calcium supplementations for the primary prevention of fractures? The evidence is actually D. And I think that, you know, you have people that haven't been keeping up on the medical literature out there. I'd say probably a good percentage of physicians have no idea that that's a vitamin a D recommendation. So for that postmenopausal community-dwelling patient, you should recommend against daily supplementation with 400 units or less of vitamin D and 1,000 milligrams or less of primary prevention. And then community-dwelling patients 65 or older with an increased risk, you should actually give the vitamin D supplementation, you know, for those folks. And it's in their handout. All right, so this is, you know, just kind of a rundown. You know, if they talk about subacute combined degeneration, think about vitamin B12 deficiency. You know, by the way, for vitamin B12 deficiency, if you get a patient that comes in, the first neurological finding for subacute combined degeneration will be loss of vibratory sensation. So that's why, you know, one of my markers, if it's a good neurologist, if they come in with a vibratory tuning fork, you know, that, and, you know, that's probably a pretty good neurologist, right? Because they're checking out, because that could be an early sign of subacute combined degeneration in those folks. Wernicke-Korsakoff, thiamine deficiency, you know, I think as you know, and this is the reason why we give thiamine before we give glucose in our patients with alcoholism. Pellagra, the four D's of pellagra, right, for niacin deficiency, dermatitis, diarrhea, dementia, and death. You know, all pretty bad. You know, niacin deficiency, pellagra, the four D's. Corkscrew hair. I mean, if you know, you talk about a buzzword, or if they show you a picture of a piece of hair that looks like corkscrew, I mean, you shouldn't even have to think about the rest of the answer. I mean, you know, maybe they'll give you some gingival bleeding and stuff like that. You know, maybe it's like that, you know, the alcoholic or whatever, poor nutrition. But if you see that corkscrew hair, if they show a picture of it, you know, it's a buzzword, you know, you just answer vibrancy. You don't even have to read the rest of the answer. Skin desquamation, think riboflavin, you know, skin desquamation. And then ecchymosis. You know, whenever you have ecchymosis, you know, I explain ecchymosis, you know, think about vitamin C and vitamin K, you know, on there. For artificial nutrition and hydration, sometimes these come up as like board questions. You know, and of course, you know, they kind of crosses the line between ethics and artificial nutrition, hydration for nutrition. I think that, you know, that from an ethical standpoint, they may ask this for you, and it's, you know, been well written out there in literature. You know, this is a medical intervention. So, you know, if they give you some ethical question or whatever, and they say, you know, what should you do in terms of this nutrition, the courts, the law of the land, it's pretty clear out there. Artificial nutrition hydration is a medical intervention. So you would just treat that like you do any other medical intervention. You know, is it something that, you know, the patient consents to? Is that something that is appropriate for the patient? You know, medical intervention is considered, you know, may be considered a futile intervention in some patients. So if you just think about it, that as a medical intervention, you'll answer that question appropriately.